Ready? May it please the court, my name is Brett Lilly, registration number 25662, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Slater Numismatics, LLC. Mr. Slater is here as well as co-counsel, Mr. Hale. I suppose as an overview, I think the best way of looking at all of this is that Annex and the trial court both read the letter of the law and in equity too literally. I think they ignore the spirit of both by rigidly interpreting the elements in this case. And I think that both the legal and the equitable claims here allow for a whole range of actionable conduct. And this case is certainly within the spirit as well as the elements of those claims, as I'll point out. And in short, all claims survive summary judgment, and Mr. Slater should have his day in court. The first thing I want to start off with is unjust enrichment, and I want to clarify a couple of points there. If you look at either the original restatement or the new restatement, third on unjust enrichment, under section one, a person who is unjustly enriched at the expense of another is subject to liability and restitution. And this is put in paragraphs 26 through 28 of the complaint. And I think that the error of the trial court in both Annex in this case is that they failed to appreciate that when Slater entered into the referral agreement with ICG, that benefited CSN as a mutual client to both. And so therefore, when Annex comes in and takes CSN, they're not only taking it from ICG, but from Slater as well. Independently of that is Slater's first strike designation on the labeled coins, which is something Annex never had, that CSN required, and that Annex took. And that was Slater's, and the trial court never mentions that. But most importantly and critically to the whole case is the whole 25%. It was the improper use of this knowledge alone that allowed Annex to come in and cut out that 25%. In other words, if they didn't know about the contract or if they didn't use that knowledge improperly, right, they would have never been able to go to CSN and say, look, we can give you a better deal. The better deal being that 25%.
And this is on your unjust enrichment argument, right? I think, or correct me, that Judge Pratt said, or was under the view that the benefit there was taken from ICS, that the folks on the other side got that information from ICS, not from your client, and therefore the benefit wasn't at your client's expense, it was at ICS's expense. Isn't that what Judge Pratt said?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and why is that? I understood your argument that maybe the law is you don't have to confer the benefit directly. I guess you're saying it's somewhat of an indirect benefit.
Well, I want to make two points there. First, it is a direct benefit, and that 25% is a direct benefit. In other words, that 25% didn't go to ICG, right? That 25% went to Slater. And who loses that 25% when Annex takes CSN improperly? Slater does. So even under at the expense of formulation, which I'll get to under wrongful gain, there is a benefit conferred on Annex at the expense of Slater, and that is the 25%. And I think that analysis is clear on its face, and the trial court erred by missing that.
Let me ask you this. If Driving Force had been totally unaware of the contract with Slater, would this be actionable?
Perhaps not as a tort. It still may be actionable under unjust enrichment. Under the tort, you have to have knowledge and intent, and if you don't have that, you don't have a tort. But I think under unjust enrichment, and I'll turn the page now and go to wrongful gain, which I think is a separate analysis under unjust enrichment, a defendant can have a gain even if it's not at the expense or loss of the plaintiff in this case. So, to take your example, if they didn't know about the 25%, but they still had all the other improper conduct, violating fiduciary duty, et cetera, duty of loyalty, then under Section 3, wrongful gain, if it's conscious wrongdoing, you can't profit by that. And so, it may not have been conscious under your hypothetical to the extent they didn't know about the 25%, but if the rest of their action was conscious, then I think that would state a claim under wrongful gain. And the importance of wrongful gain, by the way, is that it allows you to disgorge those profits going forward. And I just want to point out a couple of things. This was pled in paragraphs 29 and 30 of the complaint, where we asked for an equitable lien and an equitable trust. And I think if you look at the case of Baker versus Carpenter, there was an intentional interference case, and they said in the alternative that a constructive trust is an appropriate remedy for abuse of confidence by commission of a wrong or unconscionable conduct and questionable means to gain title, or in this case, the benefit, which would be CSM.
Was there a claim in this complaint for a constructive trust? I don't recall seeing that.
Yes, it's paragraphs 29 and 30 of the complaint, Your Honor.
Ask for constructive trust. Okay.
Yes. And again, just to point out that the new restatement leaves out the phrase at the expense of another. It used to read that a person cannot profit by their own wrong. A person is not permitted to profit by his own wrong. And the original restatement said at the expense of the another. The new restatement leaves that out to make it clear that this benefit on the part of the defendant doesn't have to correspond with the loss, although I think we have them both here. But as an alternative to the trial court's analysis, there doesn't have to be this one-to-one at the expense benefit to loss. The other thing I want to point out is that we did plead interference with intellectual property and similar rights, unfair competition, and also fiduciary duty and duty of loyalty. And violation of all of these are wrongful conduct that supports a claim under Section 3. The final thing on unjust enrichment is the new part of the Restatement 30, Section 44. And this makes it sort of a residual claim under Section 3, covering wrongful interference not covered by more specific rules. And if you read the comments in there, it makes it very clear that interference with contractual expectations will support a claim under Section 44. Now, you don't have a claim all by itself under Section 44. You have to have the underlying tort as well. But even if we don't have Section 44 with interference with contract, I think it's clear that we've got breach of fiduciary duty, breach of duty of loyalty, and unfair competition. And so all of those give us a claim under Section 3. Now I want to move on to intentional interference. The first argument here is that the trial court held that because CSN was free to leave, that there couldn't be a breach. The first and most important argument here is that this is a question of causation. And if you look at the restatement, section 766, comment O, it's very clear on that point.
Mr. Lee, if I can interrupt you, and I probably need to step back before you get to causation and get a handle on what the elements are that you're arguing. It seems to me, I mean, Krestowiak, I think, is a pretty good case for you. Mm-hmm. Krestowiak interprets 766 and says it's more than just, it's not limited just to inducing a breach. It's you can get a tort by inducing impossibility of performance or some language like that is what Krestowiak says. Is that, and that was construing Restatement 766. Is that your argument here, or are you arguing something in between breach and impossibility? Namely, are you trying to say the elements of 766A, which talk about making performance more burdensome or more expensive, apply to 766? Do you understand what I'm asking you?
I do. And let me back up and answer it this way, and I'll, I believe, get to your question, Your Honor. I think the problem that the trial court had is the idea that because CSM is free to leave, that's a future expectancy. It's not a legal right in terms of a contract. And so my argument would be that similar to 766A, but more similarly to at-will contracts, which are actionable and have been all the way back almost to Lovely versus Guy when this tort was created, the idea is that just because it's a future expectancy doesn't take away your right to a claim of action, okay? At-will contracts state a claim for intentional interference, but they receive lesser protection. First of all, they're subject to the privilege of fair competition, and it also goes to the issue of damages, which is why I think it's an issue of causation. To answer your question, Your Honor, I think that if you look at all the Supreme Court cases, going back to Weber and also Watson versus Settlemyer, all the way up through Trimble and Memorial Gardens and also Krestowiak, what they talk about is that there's a duty not to interfere. So in other words, you can't just look at a contract and say, is there a breach? And only if there's a breach is there a claim. The question is the duty of non-interference. And then interference gets broken down, of course, into it has to be intentional and improper. And I think if you look clearly at the restatement, what it talks about is that the intent to cause the result is the key. And so getting hung up on whether or not performance was impossible or there was an actual breach of performance in some ways is missing the point of the tort. The point of the tort is intentional conduct meaning to cause the result. So to answer your question here, we think first they caused the performance to be more difficult and impossible by taking away the graders.
Well, which one is it? That's the question.
It's a continuum, right? At first it was more impossible, and then finally that led to a breach over time. It wasn't like it all happened right away. These are commercial relationships.
Okay, but what I was trying to get at here, your opponent's going to say in response to the argument, I think, not to get ahead of you, that it's knows an impossible because the facts show it wasn't impossible because ICG kept doing business for another 9 months, whatever it was. That's what I'm trying to figure out if you're saying something less. For example, making performance more difficult, which or whatever the language is of 766A, if that applied here, that's a different case than if you had to show either there was inducement of a breach or inducement of impossibility of performance. And I'm still not clear. I think you're arguing that you do not have to show breach or impossibility. It's something less than that.
I think you have to show interference is okay. What you have to show.
All right. And what law do you have that supports that? Just the restatement language itself?
Yes, 766, and more importantly, all of the Colorado Supreme Court cases that talk about the duty not to interfere. They don't say there's not a duty to breach. They say there's a duty not to interfere.
And so if you interfere and don't cause damage, the discussion's over. If you do acts which would otherwise be an interference, but it doesn't, in fact, affect the performance of the contracts, then that just goes to damage.
Under the tort, correct.
Yeah.
I would say it's a different question under unjust enrichment, but under the tort, it's not a nominal tort, but you have to show some damages under Ryder, I think it is, but
there have to be damages to be actionable.
There does have to be damages.
But you could have interference without damage.
Theoretically, I suppose. Yes.
And if I can pick up on Judge Roy's question, I mean, there's no question 766 in all the cases say you have to show intentional and improper interference with performance. But it also says inducing or causing a third person not to perform the contract. So how does perform the contract fit with interfere? And you have to induce not to perform. Now you're saying something less than that, I think.
Well, you can interfere in the sense of making it more difficult to perform. You can interfere in the sense of making it impossible to perform, and you can interfere in the sense of actually causing the breach.
Now, I know that you've cited the CJI, the jury instruction, in terms of making it more difficult to perform. Do you have any Colorado authority other than the jury instruction?
I think if you look at Watson versus Settlemeyer, it's the best case that talks about interference. And also, that's an at-will case, too, so the future expectancy idea. Two points I want to make real quickly, since I'm running out of time. Prosser, section 129, page 993, makes it clear that even if there's a tort against ICG, not Slater, that if that interference leads to damage to Slater, that causes a claim. And the restatement 766 comment P also makes the same point, that if they intended to affect the contract of a specific person, then liability can attach. And this example, I think, is important. They talk about how employees or suppliers are not normally within the scope of protection unless the person intending the breach intends to affect them, quote, by acting for the purpose of interfering with their contracts. So just as suppliers or employers could be potential proper parties, we think that in the same way Slater is here too. Just because CSN was free to go where it wanted to is an issue of causation. It doesn't take away the ability to have the claim. Since I'm running out of time, I'll just cut to the chase. The other key thing is when Ax came to Slater and said, look, we've got good news and bad news. The good news is we bought Amex. The bad news is you don't get your 25% anymore. And also the exhibits 5 through 8, I think, in the complaint showed that it was intended to cause the result. And I think we've alleged enough harm and damages in terms of the lost profits going forward under either theory to show that we've got more than enough to survive summary judgment and to give Mr. Slater his day in court. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dan Lohner, and I'm here on behalf of Driving Force LLC. I'm going to call them Annex. That's what they do business as. And listening to the arguments reminded me of something a partner once told me when I first started practicing law, and that's when you're doing an argument, you get farther and farther out on a trunk, and you feel like you're farther out on a limb on a tree. It's important to come back to the trunk, and I want to bring us back to the trunk. I'm going to start with the interference claim because it's important to keep in mind that the claim is for interference with contract. And there was a contract in this case. We didn't hear much about what the contract actually says, but there's a contract in here that they've alleged was interfered with. And it's important to focus on what the key provisions of that contract are. And specifically, they are that the contract was between Mr. Slater Numismatics and ICG. And ICG, their obligation was to, in good faith and with reasonable diligence, perform work on behalf of CSN, grade coins, and then bill CSN directly, and then pay Mr. Slater 25% of the fees that came in from that work. That's it. No other obligations. That's what the contract says.
All right, so you say there's no breach. Mr. Lilly's argument is the trial court got this wrong, that he didn't have to prove a breach. Well, why doesn't Krestoviak settle that? Because Krestoviak says induce a breach or make it impossible to perform.
Sure. Two reasons. First, in terms of the case law and the argument regarding this concept of interference, if you review all those cases, interference still involves ultimately some failure to perform, whether it's a breach in a lot of the cases or in the cases that have been cited that are at will situations, a termination of the contract. Not a breach, but a termination of the contract. We don't have that here.
They put and I recognize we're now talking just whether there's a factual question, so nothing goes to, we're not here to decide that. But their evidence was you put them out of business. Not you, your clients. You took all 24 of their 26 employees. They could no longer do the business. Now, why doesn't that get you a fact question and it made it impossible for them to perform?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, if you review the record, there is no evidence in the record that supports that fact. None. There's evidence about employees being taken, but there's no evidence that they could not perform their contractual obligations. There's no evidence that there was an order submitted by CSN that wasn't fulfilled. There's no evidence that there was an order submitted by CSN that was more expensive to fulfill, such that they were unable to perform their contractual obligations. There are statements in the arguments in this appeal that refer to moving to Florida, going out of business, and this is the reason they went out of business. There's no evidence in the record to support that. None. Okay. Particularly, there's no evidence that was in front of Judge Pratt. I think when the few times there are citations to those types of facts, they're citations, if you look at them, to motions in limine that came before the motion for summary judgment was ruled on, or statements in the trial management order. So that's the first answer.
Well, how about the memorandum from Mr. Taylor that said if you have mass resignations or firing at ICG, it would be worthless and immediately unable to function, would be out of business in weeks, if not sooner. Why couldn't that be used as evidence that it would be more difficult to perform if it had fewer employees?
Absolutely. I think that...
That's some evidence.
I think it's fair that an inference could be drawn that it would be more difficult to perform if those employees are left. That's absolutely true. But you still need the second. You need some evidence that, in fact, that where an inference could be drawn that they didn't perform.
There's no evidence that you could infer that there was no performance. All the evidence in the record suggests the contrary. All the record and the evidence suggests that they did, in fact, perform. And then Mr. Slater's sought funds from them for that performance.
Let me see if I understand your argument. I have inferred a couple of things from your briefs, and I want to know if I'm inferring correctly.
Sure.
As I understand it, you're saying this case doesn't fit well within Section 766 of the restatement, and it doesn't fit well within 766A of the restatement.
I wouldn't say that at all, but I think it does fit within 766.
Okay. Help me out there.
Well, the claim is that it was an interference with contract. This is not an at-will contract. It's a contract of a term, I believe it was 15 years. The provisions that are at issue are the ones that I mentioned at the beginning of my argument, and they presented no evidence, no facts that would suggest that either of those provisions were breached. And so I think it fits squarely within 76.
Well, but if there's no breach, how can it be a 766 case? In other words, isn't there a requirement for there to be a breach under 766?
Depending on the case, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's not 766. I'm not saying that standard applies. I'm not saying that they've...
That's what. All right. Now we're starting to get back on the same track here. So you're saying the facts of this case don't fit 766.
Absolutely. But that would be the standard. Well, I would say the facts, that is, their allegations are consistent with a claim under 766. I would say they have not met the elements of a 766 claim. And I would say that the facts do not fit a 766A claim.
Okay.
Was talking about.
All right. So talk to me then about why this doesn't fit into 766. I realize that we've been talking about this for a minute, but if you could just summarize real quickly why you don't think that the evidence that was submitted to the trial court fits within 766.
Yeah. They've made essentially three arguments in terms of the interference. I mean, I can grab some water real quick. The first is that they interfered by inducing CSN, a party that was not a party to the contract, to stop doing business or doing less business with ICG.
So it's the wrong party that was using the language of the complaint interfered with, potentially.
Well, no. On that point, that in terms of the ICG versus CSN, yes. I mean, that would fit in to that would be ICG's claim to bring. If there was an interference.
Instead of Slater.
Exactly. And it would be interference with prospective business relations rather than a contract, because there was no contract between CSN and ICG. The second theory they have is that Annex interfered by engaging in conduct that prevented ICG from paying the referral fees to Slater for work that they had in fact done.
Oh, is that really their argument, or is it that prevented your client's conduct prevented ICG from performing the agreement, basically put him out of business?
That's the third argument.
I'm sorry,
Your Honor. I think they also take the position that, because in the briefs, although they say they don't need a breach, they do talk about a breach. I mean, there was a lawsuit between Slater and ICG for unpaid referral fees. They suggest, I think, at least, that somehow Annex's conduct caused or interfered with ICG's ability to pay those 25% referral fees to Slater. The problem is the actual evidence, the record shows that those the failure to pay started in August. And Annex wasn't even formed as an entity until January. So, but you're absolutely right. I mean, that they do then also make the argument that the conduct prevented ICG from actually grading coins. And that's where you get all this wrongful conduct about a plan to take away employees and a plan to destroy them. And the reality is that if you look at the evidence in the record, there is no evidence that even to infer that ICG was unable to perform the obligations in this agreement. They performed.
Forgive me. Mr. Warner, I'm trying to get my hand on where's the standard. What do you see as the standard under 766? Do you have to have, maybe you say you have to have a breach. Maybe you say breach or impossibility. You agree with Chris Skoviak and you say they didn't satisfy either. Or is there some middle ground? As I understand, Mr. Lilly is arguing for middle ground along the lines of 766A. Your argument is Chris Skoviak has the law right and...
Absolutely right. I certainly don't believe that there's a middle ground. The middle ground they're talking about is to take the word interference. It seems to me they're taking the word interference and saying that could mean all kinds of things. You know, that, you know, how, think of all the different ways someone could interfere with a contract. But ultimately, it's only actionable if it truly affects performance in some way. And if it's a contract that it requires a breach, and if it's a business arrangement or contract that's terminable at will, it at least requires some conduct that results in a termination of that relationship.
And, this may be an idiotic question, and I apologize if it is. Why, I understand what you said, it has to be a breach. Why is the standard in 766A different from the standard in 766? The two provisions point at different parties. One of them, you know, in this case would be if the interference was with ICG. The other one would be if it was an interference with Mr. Slater's company. But the standards are different under 766A, where you just have to make it more difficult or more expensive. Why wouldn't the same standard apply to 766?
Well, I personally think it draws from what ultimately is the result of the supposed interference. In a 766A case, you have someone whose ability to perform their contractual obligations has been affected such that they have to spend more money, hire more employees, whatever it might be. It made it more difficult for them to do what they needed to do under their contractual obligations. Well, assuming they performed their contract, they still sustained damages. They had to go out and hire more employees in order to fulfill their obligations. That's exactly what 766A is designed to address. There's not been a breach of the underlying contract. The problem is the party that was forced to do more things, or where they were in a situation where it was more difficult, sustained damages just by the mere fact of the interference. We don't have that in this case. And we don't have that in a 766 case. And if we did, it would be the party that had to pay more or sustain damages, notwithstanding the performance of the contract, that is in the position to bring that claim.
What's the rationale for cutting off the liability with that party and not with the party, the promisee, who gets a payment if the promisor is able, would be able to perform the contract, but the promisor's performance is made more difficult by the alleged tortfeasor.
Well, in my view, Your Honor,
I understand that the restatement doesn't go that far, sure. But what's the policy rationale for cutting it off there?
There is no loss to the promisee. The whole point is that the promisor had to extend resources and sustain damages in order to fulfill the promisor's contractual obligations.
But if the promisor doesn't get the benefit of that performance, isn't the promisee also damaged as a result of the tortfeasor's action?
You're describing a situation where there is, in fact, a breach, though. And you're describing a situation where if the promisee is damaged at all, it will be because the promisor didn't perform. It doesn't matter to the promisee how much the promisor had to pay to perform, or how many employees they had to hire to perform. What matters to the promisee is that there was performance. If there wasn't performance and they sustained actual damage, then we're in a situation where there's been a breach of the contract between the promisor and promisee.
Can I see if I think I understand what you're saying, and this is helpful to me. So under 766A, your argument is that if it was Mr. Slater who was claiming, you prevented me from performing, he would have a claim not only if he was prevented totally from performing and therefore breached, he would also have a claim if he actually performed, but it was more expensive for him to do so because he had to go hire employees, whatever else.
That's exactly right.
All right.
So I have a minute and 30 left, so I do want to talk a little bit about the unjust enrichment claim, if I might. To be frank, with this amount of time, the problem I have with where we're at on the unjust enrichment claim in this case is I don't know what the standard is that they're proposing. I honestly don't. It seems that they are relying on this Section 44 of the restatement, which, and I've read it a number of times, it appears to be a catch-all. If something seems unfair, then there's a claim. And First, there's no Colorado cases to recognize that concept. Colorado cases do have elements for an unjust enrichment claim, and I think they are clear, and our position is they have not met those elements. But second, when we talk about the benefit was supposedly taken by my client, the benefit that they identify is this idea of getting CSN's business without the referral fee. So it's the saving of the 25% is the benefit to Annex. Annex never had an obligation to pay any kind of referral fee. If they go to CSN, and let's assume that they undercut the prices that were being paid by ICG. So they find out, they ask CSN, how much do you pay for your coin grading? They say, well, ICG charges us $20 a coin. They say, we'll do it for 18, okay? So they've taken that business. And in addition, they don't have to pay 25% like ICG has to pay, okay? They never had to pay 25%. They didn't gain anything by getting that client from CSN. There's no benefit that relates to that referral agreement. The referral agreement is between ICG and Mr. Slater. So in my view, based on everything we just heard, there is no benefit such that they can get into this catch-all concept of wrongful conduct that results in a benefit, regardless of whether there's any detriment to the plaintiff, is actionable as unjust enrichment. I think Judge Pratt got it right.
Thank you, counsel. I think both counsel are out of time.